and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Senator Bernie Sanders, who many are now speculating could have beaten Donald Trump had he gotten the Democratic nomination. We will discuss his new book, Our Revolution, A Future to Believe In, that tells the inside story of his insurgent challenge of the corporate establishment and the plutocracy, which, although he started out with no name recognition, no money, or political organization, and was written off by the punditry as a fringe candidate and a long shot, got more than 13 million votes in the Democratic primaries and won 22 states, starting a political revolution that, although the campaign is over, will continue as the struggle goes on, particularly now with the reactionary takeover of the American government, the courts, and the economy by a cabal of petty, vindictive ideologues and dangerous amateurs. Then we'll examine the possibility of the return of the neocons in foreign policy now that John Bolton and Rudy Giuliani are the reported frontrunners for Secretary of State, and James Woolsey is on the shortlist for National Security Advisor. Jacob Halbrin, a senior editor at The National Interest and author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons, joins us to discuss the apparent capture of the outsider by Washington insiders. Then we will speak with Michael Heaney, a professor of organizational studies and political science at the University of Michigan, about the narrow victory of 107,000 votes Donald Trump got in the Rust Belt states of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan that sealed his victory in the Electoral College, even though Hillary Clinton won as much as 2 million more popular votes. We will discuss the close race in Michigan and why, since Bernie Sanders had won the state in the primary, his messages were ignored by the Clinton campaign. Then finally, with an anti-immigration zealot Kris Kovach in charge of Trump's immigration policies and a top candidate for the next United States Attorney General, we will look into the drafting of a proposal to register Muslims, as well as plans to immediately deport 2 to 3 million undocumented immigrants who may or may not have criminal records. Kamal Ezahab, an immigration policy attorney at the National Immigration Law Center, joins us to discuss growing concerns in immigrant communities of a pending mass roundup. And joining us now is Senator Bernie Sanders, who ran as a Democratic candidate for President of the United States in the recent election. He served as the sole congressperson for the state of Vermont in the U.S. House of Representatives, then was elected to the Senate in 2007, and is now in his second term, making him the longest-serving independent in the history of the U.S. Congress. He also serves on the Environment and Public Works and on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committees, and has a new book just out, Our Revolution, A Future to Believe In. Welcome to Background Briefing, Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator, it's been quite a while since we were at the rally in Hollywood back in March of 2015 that I emceed with you, and quite a lot has happened since then, and you've written about it in Our Revolution, A Future to Believe In. But today you were in front of the White House, joined with Native American protesters whose ancestral land is being torn up and dogs have been sicked on them and pepper spray has been used on women and children. So clearly there's a connection, is there not, between your protest today and in front of the White House?
In my book, I mentioned that meeting in Hollywood. It was a beautiful Sunday, I think it was.
It was.
just a huge turnout, and thank you very much for being the MC. And that was one of the events that made me think, when I was thinking about should I run or should I, kind of grassroots support that we need. So that was one of the meetings that made me think, you know what, there may be a whole lot of people who are tired of status quo politics who want real change in this country. And thank you again for your help on that. In terms of yesterday, in terms of the Dakota pipeline, look, what you got are several enormously important issues. Everybody, I think, understands that the Native American people from day one, from before this country became a country, have been lied to, they've been cheated, the treaties that have been worked out with them have been abrogated, and that has gone on throughout history. Today, in many, many Native American communities, just enormous poverty, lack of respect, sovereignty rights being trampled on. And my view is that we have got to respect Native American sovereignty. We have to understand that water, the preservation of clean water, is a global crisis. We cannot endanger water by pipelines that, if broken, could deny clean water to millions of people. And last but certainly not least, the question that we have to ask ourselves is, at a time when the entire scientific community is telling us of the enormous threat to the future of this planet, of climate change, the fact that we're getting warmer and warmer, more drought, more floods, more extreme weather disturbances, does it make any sense at all to be building more pipelines, to becoming more dependent upon fossil fuel, as opposed to transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy? So those are, you know, those are the issues that are out there, and I think the American people have got to stand up and stand by our Native American brothers and sisters and fight for a set of policies which takes on the fossil fuel industry and transforms our energy system.
Well, clearly at this moment, Senator Sanders, millions of Americans are in a state of shock about the recent election outcome and the most least qualified, most contentious, and most controversial candidate to ever run for president was elected by 107,000 votes in the Electoral College in key states in the Rust Belt, and Hillary Clinton got 2 million more votes in the popular vote. How are you processing this?
Well, you know, I will be very honest with you and tell you that Tuesday night was a very, very depressing night for me personally. It was depressing not only in seeing Trump win the presidency, but seeing Republicans retain control over the Senate. I had hoped to be chairman of the Health, Education, and Labor Committee and had some fantastic ideas about moving forward in terms of universal health care and raising the minimum wage and making public colleges and universities tuition-free. And I'm not going to be in a leadership position of that committee to do that. So that was also disappointing. But I think as a nation, we don't have the luxury of living in despair or simply complaining. Our job right now is to educate, is to organize, is to fight back. And I honestly believe from the bottom of my heart is that if millions of people stand together, we can defeat the bigotry that came out of the Trump campaign, the racism, the sexism, the xenophobia. If we stand together. But we got to be smart. We have to be smart. And being smart means that we need to bring people together. We need to understand why Trump won. And one of the reasons, in my view, and others may disagree, but in my view, one of the reasons that Trump won is that the pain among the working class and the middle class of this country is far deeper than the pundits understand. You know, the average pundit on TV makes $2 billion a year, lives in a wonderful condo, has a, you know, economically well off. And yet right now, in this country, there are people who work in two or three jobs. There are mothers who are paying $12,000, $15,000 a year for child care, and they're making $40,000 a year. There are half of the older workers in this country don't have a nickel set aside for their retirement. People are scared, and meanwhile, the people on the top 1% are making out like bandits, making huge amounts of money. Corporate profits are soaring. People are in despair, and they're saying, how does it happen that my kid is going to have a lower standard of living than I do, and 52% of all new income is going to the top 1%? We need change. We need change. And then, pathetically, Mr. Trump becomes the agent of change, this multi-billionaire who has, you know, done so much harm in his life. He becomes the agent of change. Well, we do need real change. Mr. Trump, I don't think, is going to deliver that change. But we need to bring people together to create an economy that stands for all of us, and that means having the guts. And I'm going to do my best to make sure the Democratic Party understands this, and it's going to be a hard fight. But the Democratic Party has got to be a leader in taking on Wall Street, in taking on the drug companies. I was out in California, as you may know, sure, fighting for Proposition 61. Drug companies spent $130 million in California to make sure that the people in that state and in this country continue to pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. We've got to take them on, and we've got to take on the fossil fuel industry. So it is not a time for despair. It is time for people to come together and fight back.
Well, it seems as though the outsider, Donald Trump, has already been captured by the insiders in Washington, and one wonders whether or not at the end of the day he may end up being the useful idiot for the Republican establishments, for the Koch brothers, etc. Do you see him as exerting any of his promises? At the end of the day, I'm not sure that he's going to bring back jobs to Youngstown, Ohio.
Well, the answer is nobody knows, and I'm not much into speculation. This is what I do know. And people have got to be honest about this. You may not like Trump. I did. I spent the last 2 weeks of the campaign visiting 12 states, doing everything that I could to see that Trump was defeated and that Clinton, you know, could win. But what has to be appreciated is Trump ran the most unconventional campaign, certainly in our lifetime. Trump took on not just the Democrats. He took on the Republican leadership. He was there with his rhetoric, at least, attacking Wall Street, attacking the drug companies, attacking corporate America. Now, what you're suggesting, and I tend to agree with you, those are fine words for a campaign. What happens the day after the election? Those people are circling around them right now. Stock market is doing just fine. I don't think the drug companies are worried that he said that he would take them on. So it's a complicated issue. But at the end of the day, the only antidote to Trump is mass organizing, people coming together around the progressive agenda and fighting back. And if we do that, you know, I think we can mitigate some of the most ugly policies that he was talking about.
Well, it would seem, though, that our revolution, the revolution that you began with your campaign and will continue in 4 years' time, if the very people who the Democrats did not appeal to and should have appealed to, they've been their traditional base, if they are disillusioned, it would seem to me that we will be even more ripe for a revolution, and those that have been misguided and taken for a ride may well be ready for the truth.
Well, I think so, and I think, you know, I see this as not just a victory for Trump and the Republicans, but a loss for the Democrats, in the sense that for a variety of reasons, which we don't have the time right now to get into, I mean, they have failed to communicate with working-class people. They have failed to excite young people, whether those young people are black or white or Latino or Asian-American or Native American. The vision is not the kind of vision that exists out there, should exist. Here is the bottom line, and if I said it once, I've said it 1,000 times. We are the wealthiest country in the history of the world. If we were a poor country, you and I would be having a very different discussion. We are the richest country in the history of the world. Healthcare should be a right of all people. Public colleges and universities should be tuition free. We should be leading the world in combating climate change. We should not have the highest rate of childhood poverty of almost any major country on earth, and more income and wealth inequality than any other country. All right. But the reason that is happening is that, you know, we have not effectively addressed those issues, mobilized people around those issues, and that is what we have got to do.
Well, the president is in Germany today, and Germany is a social democracy, and you're a social democrat, and they have managed to have an incredibly healthy economy with half of the members of the boards of directors of all big companies,
right,
in the representatives of the unions. They have free health care, free tuition and education, three weeks vacation, you name it, all the stuff that we can only dream of, and it hasn't hurt their economy. So this is
quite the contrary.
Right.
And there is, I mean, that's what I try to do in my campaign, is to look beyond, look about what's going on in the rest of the world. Look at where we can become. Think big, not small. All right, with that, Ian, I have to apologize and get off right now. But I look forward to chatting with you in the not-too-distant future.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, good.
Great.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And I've been speaking with Senator Bernie Sanders, who ran as a Democratic candidate for President of the United States in the recent election. He served as the sole congressperson for the state of Vermont in the U.S. House of Representatives and was elected to the Senate in 2007. It is now in his second term, making him the longest-serving independent in the history of the Congress. He also served on the Environment and Public Works and on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committees, and has a new book just out, Our Revolution, A Future to Believe In. We can take a brief station break and back examining the possibility of the return of the neocons in foreign policy.
What's my name? What's my station? Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be
justice to you, or bow down and be grateful and say, sure, take all that you see to the men who move on me in dimly lit halls and determine my future for me.
But one thing that is certain, life is good.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jacob Halbron, who's a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for The Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at The New Republic. His latest article at The National Interest is Trump's Road to Victory. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob Halbron.
Thank you, Ian.
And what do you make of the very real possibility that John Bolton could be Donald Trump's Secretary of State or Rudolph Giuliani? They are the front runners at the moment. And in terms of the National Security Advisor, James Woolsey is also on the short list. Kelly Ayotte as well, I believe. So the neocons seem to be circling.
Well, it shows you that Trump is a protean figure who's really a showman and has no fixed ideology. He did condemn the Iraq war and interventionism and wars in the Middle East during the campaign. But he is a malleable figure who is highly susceptible to whoever is around him. And the great danger of his entire campaign has been that the neocons, far from being destroyed, will see their restoration under Trump by hijacking his presidency.
Well, but you have to add to that there's a pettiness and a vindictiveness to Trump and the people around him. In other words, if you didn't support us, forget about it, you know. And if you're anything to do with the Democrats, you guys lost. Tell your story walking. I mean, that seems to be their attitude. That's what we're hearing from these chaotic transition meetings.
Yeah, you definitely have to be a loyalist to Trump, but don't forget that Bolton has been assiduously trying to cultivate his relationship with Trump for months, and he never joined the neoconservative-led Never Trump movement. So, and Bolton is more of an American nationalist than someone who believes in trying to promote democracy abroad. When he supported the Iraq war, I met him when he was in the Bush administration before the war had actually taken place, when he was in the State Department, and he was quite explicit that he had no interest in trying to democratize Iraq. He's simply someone who believes in the unilateral exercise of American power. And in that sense, temperamentally, he fits in very well with Trump's own disdain for international organizations and American allies. John Bolton has no patience for allies who he believes tie down the United States and prevent it from flexing its muscles abroad.
But how can any of these people reconcile Trump's relations with Putin and the very real possibility that Putin tipped the scales on this election?
Well, that's the huge question that I've been puzzling over, Ian, and I can't give you a definitive answer. Bolton, for example, said a year or two ago that we need to, quote, cause Putin pain, unquote. And many of the General Michael Flynn has also taken in his book that he co-authored with Michael Ledeen on what they see as the jihadi threat to America. Flynn also refers to the enemy alliance of Russia, Iran. So I am still perplexed, but you have to remember that Trump only has inchoate foreign policy impulses. I don't even think that you can say that he necessarily has a coherent worldview at this point.
Well, the idea that, I mean, the fact that Flynn went to Moscow on Putin's dime, you know, sat a couple of chairs away from him, wrote this book with the uber neocon, Michael Ledeen, the guy that threatened to sue me, that's in itself pretty extraordinary. I mean, there's obviously a growing alliance now between Russia and Iran. And I mean, it would be imaginative. I always wondered why we threw our lot in with these corrupt Sunni medieval monarchs in Saudi Arabia. And I think Obama got that message and tried to make a deal with Iran. But I'm not sure that the supreme leader is playing ball. There does seem to be a real alliance brewing there, wouldn't you say?
Definitely. One of the names that you did not mention, Ian, and I'm surprised that we haven't so far, is Frank Gaffney.
Oh, well, he's mad as a hatter, that one.
Now, he is alleged, it's written in the Wall Street Journal last night that he has joined the Trump transition team.
So he's the Muslim hater, the Muslim basher. But what position would they give him?
You know, well, no one knows what this is all up in the air. But I mean, one possibility would be that he would join the National Security Council. One of his deputies is being mooted as becoming deputy national security advisor. It's just very, everything is in flux. I don't think that the Trump campaign has made any firm decisions, and it's possible that he comes up with an entirely different cast of characters within a week. Another name that was mentioned today was Nikki Haley for Secretary of State. So the campaign seems to be bouncing all over the place. I mean, if you trust the news reports, there are a series of purges taking place and a huge amount of upheaval within the transition team.
Well, they got rid of Mike Rogers because he was apparently close to Chris Christie, and they brought in Jeff Sessions. And, of course, the vice president, Mike Pence, he apparently was at some delay because he hadn't signed the requisite papers, but he seems to be playing a bigger role.
In the end, I believe that Pence will be Cheney plus in this administration.
Well, that's my sense that this guy, this amateur is just basically, in many ways, he may well be a useful idiot for the Republican establishment in Washington and the Koch brothers.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, the other option, there are so many different options for Trump. A different one is that he does not become the captive of the Republican establishment, but he could either try to govern as an actual populist, or he could try and triangulate and reach out to the Democrats. I think John Boehner had it right when he said yesterday that Trump is barely a Republican, and then he said he might barely be a Democrat, too. We've elected someone who does not appear to have a fixed ideology.
Well, that could be a good thing. I mean, I just cannot get my head around the fact that, you know, that there's any virtue in this man, because his record is so bad, and he's been so destructive and poisonous and petty. Where is the virtue? I mean, I understand the tactics.
I wrote a piece for Politico saying that the best scenario would be that Trump was the great dissembler during the campaign, and that he actually becomes the pragmatic businessman lurking beneath the carapace of this irrational and belligerent showman that we saw during the campaign. What worries me is that we've entered an era that is entirely unpredictable. We simply do not know what is coming and which Trump will manifest itself.
So it's possible then that the guy that doesn't seem to have a clue about anything, doesn't know anything about government, doesn't know anything about national security, doesn't know anything about foreign policy, may ultimately be really smart about the big things. Is that what you're saying? That he may have...
I don't preclude it. I mean, there is the possibility that Trump would follow more the course that Reagan did in his second term, which is if he ends up putting in reasonable people and decides that he actually wants to have arms control, he's indicated in the past that he does, that he's a fervent believer that he can slash the nuclear forces when the Soviet Union existed. Reagan took what was called a useful idiot by the right after he reached out to Gorbachev. So presidents can take very unpredictable courses. We have to hope that Trump does not, in fact, become a captive of the neoconservatives and does, in fact, try to reorient American foreign policy in a positive direction.
Well, we've already seen, though, after his phone call with Putin, immediately they hang up the phone, Putin starts to pound the hell out of Aleppo, and it looks like, along with the Iranians and the Assad regime, they're going to take Aleppo for probably pretty soon. There'll be a massive exodus of Sunni from Syria into Turkey, and then on their way to Europe. And what happened a couple summers ago in Europe will be nothing compared to what will happen. Yeah. And so again, Putin
is... Well, the nightmare scenario is exactly what you're painting, which is that Trump gets taken to the cleaners by these foreign authoritarian leaders, that the post-Cold War order that the Americas constructed after World War II based on free trade and liberal democracy goes by the wayside. Foreign powers become increasingly aggressive. The United States is abandoned by Western Europe and seen as an enemy by Germany and France. And NATO dissolves, and we're back to the world that existed during the interwar period after World War I.
Well, you have to add to that, too, the end of the TPP, which is really has more to do with geopolitics and defense than it has to do with trade. The idea behind it was to get everybody in the neighborhood in Asia organized against the Chinese behemoth. And we've seen how aggressive the Chinese have been in the islands between the Philippines and Vietnam, which they've claimed for themselves. So that's another blow, if you will, to certainly what Obama was planning. I mean, that was his pivot to Asia, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, one of these Al-Qaeda theorists who was quoted in Foreign Affairs today is saying that Trump is the man who will point the dagger at the heart of the American empire, that this is the final blow to American superpower status.
Well, a lot of people might agree with that. it's always been, the question's always arisen, will the Republic survive the empire? The idea of filling potholes in Kabul and not filling potholes in Main Street USA has a certain appeal, doesn't it?
Right. Well, let's not forget that Trump did come to power on the basis of legitimate grievances that the Democratic Party wholly ignored and that the Republican Party had ignored as well. And he smashed both Clinton and the Bushes, and in the South Carolina debate, and during the primary, he said that the Bushes had lied America into the Iraq War, and he was not repudiated by the Republican base, but embraced. So there could be a sea change, a violent reaction against the elites that have steered American foreign policy in recent decades. And you cannot argue that our record has been a shining one since 9/11. The United States has conducted itself in an utterly disastrous manner.
Well, Jacob Halperin, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jacob Halperin, who is a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for The Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at The New Republic. And his latest article at The National Interest is Trump's Road to Victory. And joining us now is Michael Heaney, who's a professor of Organizational Studies and Political Science at the University of Michigan. Previously, Michael was the William A. Stiegler Congressional Fellow of the American Political Science Association, during which time he worked on the staff of the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Energy and Commerce under Chairman John Dingell, and is the co-author of Party in the Street, the Anti-War Movement and the Democratic Party After 9/11. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Heaney.
Pleased to be with you.
And Michael, we started out with Senator Bernie Sanders, who has a book, Our Revolution, and he was talking about the need to continue the revolution, particularly now with the election of Donald Trump. So since you're the co-author of Party in the Street, is the defeated Democratic Party going to get into the street?
Well, I don't know if the Democratic Party will, but I know that the progressive left side of the political spectrum definitely will. And we've already seen them out in the streets in the last week. And I expect that we'll see more of that in the coming months and years.
And what's the sense then of direction as opposed to frustration and anger and letting off steam?
Well, I don't know that there is a clear sense of direction yet. I think that most of it right now is what you just said, anger and letting off steam. Whether they're able to direct that into something that might be a force for policy change or for a force to resist the Trump administration is something that's yet to be seen.
Well, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, Michael, is since you are in Michigan, was how extraordinarily narrow the Electoral College victory of Donald Trump's was. If in the four key states, Pennsylvania, three key states actually, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, 107,000 votes we're talking about here, and in Michigan, they actually are still counting, but right, they've given it to Donald Trump with a razor-thin margin of 13,107 votes out of the 4,785,223 votes cast. And again, the counting won't close till November the 28th, I believe.
Right.
So that's extraordinarily close. Now, given that we started out talking with Bernie Sanders, who, as you know, won the Democratic primary in Michigan very handily. How come the Clinton people didn't notice what Bernie Sanders' appeal was in Michigan and what his proposals and platform was that resonated with the Democratic voters who didn't show up?
I don't think you can point entirely to this as a strategic loss, that somehow there was something that the Clinton people didn't see, that, you know, because they didn't see that they lost for that reason. I think if they had seen it, I think they still would have lost for the same reason, which is that both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders had a appeal to middle-class, working-class voters, white voters in rural areas that the Hillary Clinton campaign just didn't have. So I'm not sure that it's that they missed something as much as they just didn't have that appeal. And I think that part of the reason for that is they weren't offering policies that appealed to those people. And they weren't offering policies that offered people in the middle parts of the economic spectrum a sense that they would be taking a step up economically with the Clinton administration.
Well, the Huffington Post is reporting that in Michigan alone, a senior battleground state operative told the Huffington Post that the state party and local officials were running at roughly one-tenth the paid canvassers capacity that Senator John Kerry had when he ran for president in 2004, and that they were desperate for more human capital. Does that sound like the incorrect allocation of resources?
No, I mean, I think that I wouldn't say the problem with the Clinton campaign was the incorrect allocation of resources. I think it was more the clash between Clinton and Trump and what people found important and appealing and what they didn't. So the Clinton campaign really put its eggs in the basket of Donald Trump is unfit for the presidency. And for people who care more about their pocketbooks, they, I'm not sure, cared that Donald Trump was unfit for the presidency. If they felt like he was someone that could bring back manufacturing jobs, then maybe they were willing to have someone that was rougher around the edges. So I'm not sure it was getting out the vote, the ground game kind of issues. I think it was more the arguments that were being made by the candidates themselves and their campaigns.
Well, certainly in the last week or so, Donald Trump had very effective commercials and a very effective message. And apparently there was a massive fight within the Clinton administration, a Clinton campaign, particularly with Bill Clinton wanting to go after the very voters that we're talking about that defected in the Rust Belt with a new message, with an economic message. But the campaign decided instead to go back to the theme of that Trump is horrible. And, of course, the subtext of the Trump is horrible theme in a way is that if you vote for him, you're stupid, which is not necessarily an appealing message. Doesn't that touch on that sort of deplorable whiff there?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that this approach where you sort of go and try to construct what the campaign did in the last weeks tells us about the outcome. I think the outcome has to do with the broader arch of the campaign. And one point I'd like to make is I think that what the Trump campaign did that was very effective was they did a very effective job of painting Hillary Clinton as corrupt. Donald Trump said that she was the most corrupt person to ever seek the office of the presidency, which, of course, is a ridiculous claim. But nonetheless, he was able to very effectively project that. And I think that that turned off a lot of voters. As I was looking over the election results in preparation for this call, one of the things that I found was interesting is that Hillary Clinton lost more than enough votes in Wayne County, which is the urban county where Detroit is, lost more than enough votes in Wayne County to lose Michigan. So in 2008, Barack Obama won 656,000 votes in Wayne County. And in 2016, Hillary Clinton won 517,000. So she lost, there were over 100,000 people less voting for Hillary Clinton just in Wayne County. And the explanation for that is that the Trump campaign did a good job of painting her as corrupt so that people that were part of her base that would have turned out for Obama didn't turn out for her.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Heaney, a professor of organizational studies and political science at the University of Michigan. Previously, he was a congressional fellow of the American Political Science Association, during which time he worked on the staff of the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Energy and Commerce under Chairman John Dingell, and is the co-author of Party in the Street, the Anti-War Movement and the Democratic Party After 9/11. Since you worked with John Dingell on the Energy and Commerce Committee, what do you make of the I was talking earlier with Jacob Harbron about the idea that maybe the outsider, Donald Trump, is being captured by the Washington insiders, all these lobbyists. He certainly got a lot of lobbyists in charge of the energy portfolios, whether they end up in Interior or where elsewhere in the government.
That's the way the government works, and that's the way Congress works. I know when I worked for Chairman Dingell, definitely I spent a lot of time working with lobbyists because lobbyists know policy, and lobbyists can be extremely helpful in helping members of Congress and their staffs understand what's going on. And a lot of cases, lobbyists are former members of Congress or they're former congressional staffers themselves. So the reason why people turn to them when it's time to govern is that these are people that have quite a lot of expertise.
Right, but they also have an agenda.
Well, individually, they may not have much of an agenda. I mean, lobbyists are like lawyers. You know, they will work for the clients that pay them, and they'll work for on the issue and the side that they're willing to, that they're being paid to work on. But when it comes right down to it, these are the people that know the ins and outs, that know the line by line of the policies. So one of the things that, for example, the Tea Party would always criticize the members of Congress on is they would say, look, the members of Congress are not reading the bills. You know, how can they possibly know what's in these bills if they don't read them? Well, there is someone that reads the bills. It's the congressional staff. And those congressional staff become lobbyists, and they're the ones that know the ins and outs of the policies. And so that's why Democrats, Republicans alike will turn to lobbyists when it's time to govern.
So, but if the lobbyists themselves don't have agendas, their clients who hire them do, surely.
Well, some of the lobbyists definitely have agendas. But, you know, I've done interviews with over 400 lobbyists. And I can tell you that these are public-spirited, intelligent, highly knowledgeable people. And they're the kind of people that you're going to want to have working in government.
So what's your sense?
And I get no money for saying that. I'm just telling you from having,
right.
I've interviewed lobbyists on both sides, not just both sides, but across the political spectrum. And, you know, you meet a few lobbyists who are highly ideologically driven that have a clear agenda. But I would say that on the whole, most lobbyists are really just interested in particular areas of public policy. And of course, they want to make a lot of money working on those areas of public policy. But they're not, I would say the overwhelming majority of lobbyists are not driven by any particular agenda other than to do a good job working for their employer so that they can make money.
Well, but the point, man, that Donald Trump has for the energy portfolio is a global warming denier. And he surely has an agenda.
Okay.
Pardon?
No, all right, I won't dispute you on that.
Right. So what's your sense then of whether that agenda will prevail, or whether the more professional lobbyists who know their way around the town will prevail? In other words, it seems to me that you could make the case that Donald Trump is obviously a neophyte. He doesn't know anything about foreign policy, national security. He's never had government experience. He's never had military experience. So, is he prey to that kind of takeover in effect, or is he more? Does he have core beliefs, and these people that he's put in charge signal the kind of direction he's going to go?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question, but what I would say is that, I mean, I share some of the concerns that you have. I mean, global warming is probably one of the things that worries me most about the Trump administration, is that he seems to be very determined to set back the clock on some of the advances that were made during the Obama administration, particularly with regard to the Paris Accords. And you know, I worry that he's going to undo these advances. And I'm not sure that the reason he's going to undo these advances is because he's appointed, lobbyists who want to undo the advances, as much as that seems to be one of the promises that he made to his constituents that he'll need to deliver on if he wants to be reelected. So I'm very worried about it. I'm not sure I would blame the lobbyists.
Well, Michael Heaney, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Heaney, who's a professor of organizational studies and political science at the University of Michigan. Previously, Michael was the William A. Steger Congressional Fellow of the American Political Science Association, during which time he worked on the staff of the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Energy and Commerce under Chairman John Dingell, and is the co-author of Party in the Street, the Anti-War Movement and the Democratic Party After 9/11. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into Donald Trump's possible immigration policies and whether or not they'll be registering Muslims, and what will the fate be of the 2 to 3 million people that are supposed to be deported.
If the lakes took the place of the sea, if the cars drove themselves, wait and be opposite to the trains moving in, rivers run interstate Michigan.
Look at me, I just can't believe what they've done to me. We could never be free.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kamal Esaheb, who is an immigration policy attorney at the National Immigration Law Center, who engages in advocacy and technical assistance relating to state and local enforcement of immigration law and access to legal status for immigrants. His advocacy focuses on passage of the DREAM Act, implementation of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, and state and local enforcement of immigration laws. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kamal Esaheb.
Thank you for having me.
And of course, the DACA that you work on, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival programs, that seems to be the most vulnerable constituency, because they are in here in the United States being protected by an executive order Barack Obama implemented, and that Donald Trump can overturn with a stroke of a pen. Am I right?
That's right. And you know, it's, really unfortunate that we have a population of almost 800,000, immigrant youth, young people who grew up here, who went to school here, have contributed so much to this country and are really essentially American, and who have, because of this program that's been in place since 2012, have been able to contribute even more to their communities. And there have been several studies done about this. I mean, you look at their income and it, how much they pay in taxes, and you look at how many of them have been able to buy houses and go to college and just further contribute not only to themselves and their families, but to their broader communities. So the fact that we have, three quarter of a million people like that, who are essentially American, that are, with a stroke of a pen, could lose their jobs immediately, could, lose their, health care, and lose access to this program that's made their lives and their communities' lives and their communities better, is very concerning.
But what about the children that arrived from Central America unaccompanied? My understanding is, for example, in places like Honduras, which has the highest murder rate, or somewhere at least equivalent to the murder rate in Venezuela, but it's pretty bad, and El Salvador, which is apparently largely controlled by gangs, at least in terms of the young kids. If you don't join a gang, then you're very vulnerable. And parents apparently had just been sending these kids out of the country, taking an extremely risky trip through Mexico on, hitching on freight trains, etc., getting robbed and mugged and raped, etc., on the way. And they get up here and they surrender themselves. And now I understand that Donald Trump's going to throw them back into a very uncertain fate.
Yeah, I mean, that is a different population, but it's also a population that we, really care about for a lot of the reasons that you mentioned. These are young people who are escaping, the worst of life circumstances, the worst of, conditions, and they have legitimate reasons to seek protection, from the United States. And the United States has obligations because of international law, because of our own asylum laws, to provide them that protection. So the idea that we would take, young people, some teenagers, some even younger, and send them back to in some cases, certain deaths. And we know, it's been documented, that dozens of people who, by this current administration, have been sent back, without being, and not given the protection of our asylum laws, have actually been killed upon return to Central America. So to see that even magnified, and to see even higher numbers of those individuals not afforded the kind of protection that that we owe them, is of a grave concern to us.
So when Donald Trump talks about, as he did on 60 Minutes, that he's going to deport 2 to 3 million people first and fairly soon, immediately, and these he referred to as criminals. But the other 11 to 12 million, the rest of the 11 to 12 million, he doesn't have, he didn't say what he was going to do about that. Now, if you just take those figures on the surface, is it accurate to say that 1/4 of the undocumented population in the United States are criminals? That seems, every undocumented immigrant I've ever met has been extremely honest and hardworking, decent people. So how do you get that statistic that, 3 million of the 12 million are criminals?
It's fuzzy math, and actually the Washington Post did a fact check on that and found it, questionable. Look, I mean, the reality is, I think part of what this election has taught us is maybe, we don't have to pay attention to every detail that comes out of President-elect Trump's mouth. The reality is what he's doing there is he's trying to create the impression that immigrants are all criminals. We don't have to look very hard to see that's really his motivation. The day he announced that he was running for president, he called Mexicans, criminals and rapists and drug dealers. And then sort of almost under his breath, and some of them are good people. So I think the reality is whatever numbers he puts out there, what he's trying to do is paint an entire population with a broad brush. And I think, for us, I think we are just, we will wait and see what his actual policy proposals are, and we will challenge them, as they come up.
And again, I'm speaking with Kamal Esaheb, who's a immigration policy attorney at the National Immigration Law Center. Well, let's turn to Chris Kobach, who's the point man in the Trump transition on immigration, and he's also being named as a possible Attorney General of the United States, and he's quite a zealot. He's about as hardline as you get in terms of being against immigrants with a detectable tinge of racism. So, what is what does that say to you? And two, what will this guy do if he's Attorney General?
Well, I think he will do what he's been doing for the past few years, which, even in his, elected position as Secretary of State of Kansas, which, sounds like a full-time job to me, he's made a hobby of drafting laws and policies and pitching them to anti-immigrant legislators and states and localities to try to make life as difficult as possible for immigrants. Now, just about all of these laws, the ones that passed, have been struck down by courts. These are not efforts that are legal. These are not efforts that are constitutional. They're meant to be punitive. And, at the end of the day, he gets an opportunity to push an agenda through some of these state legislators and leaves the states and cities with hefty legal bills when they lose their cases. So he is certainly no friend of immigrants. He is, like I said, just made a hobby of trying to make life as difficult as possible for immigrants everywhere.
So what do you make of this plan that he's drafting, this proposal to register Muslims?
Well, he is the architect of a similar plan from 2002 registered tens of thousands of immigrants from predominantly Muslim countries, and you know, what we saw from that program, it's called Special Registration, is that communities were decimated. People were, you know, in an environment not unlike this one, the post 9/11 environment, where people of color, particularly people from the Middle East and South Asia, were living a life of daily fear, where, you know, individuals were interrogated by, you know, the FBI and held in detention for long periods of time. Some, you know, there are stories of people who just disappeared. And in the midst of that, Chris Kobach created this program that required individuals who were already under siege, communities that were already under siege, to, you know, show up to a government office and subject themselves to, you know, interviewing, fingerprinting, and you know, not surprisingly, tens of thousands of people were deported as a result of it. And I just have to think, you know, to a community in New York City, along Coney Island Avenue, which had been a vibrant, you know, corridor of shops and restaurants and, you know, just a lively part of New York City, you know, within months, it was, you know, just boarded up. People left. People either were deported or left in fear. So I think back to that, and I think about the current environment where all immigrant communities, Latino, Asian, South Asian, Arab, are in fear. They heard the election narrative. They you know, they've witnessed the hate crimes. They've experienced hate crimes. I just saw data the other day that anti-Muslim hate crimes are higher than they were after 9/11. And to compound that terror that these communities face with, you know, a program where you have to, you know, line up and get into a government office and subject, you know, be subject to an interrogation, is fundamentally un-American.
Well,
I mean, it brings thoughts of, you know, Nazi Germany, and and it's not who we are as a country.
Well, Kamal Esaheb, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right, thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Kamal Esaheb, who's an immigration policy attorney at the National Immigration Law Center, where he focuses on the passage of the DREAM Act, implementation of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, and state and local enforcement of immigration laws. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.